previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
No. No.
You'll learn to love it.
Hell, I won't.
Is The Lost Wife of Robert Durst worth finding on Lifetime On Demand? I've sworn in some expert witnesses for The Blotter Presents, Episode 30. Hello again, everyone. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting. This is The Blotter Presents, Episode 30, and look what the cat McPhee dragged in for a discussion of The Lost Wife of Robert Durst. Thank you for laughing at that. It was terrible. I've impaneled a jury of smashologists to talk about this fine Lifetime product. I'm joined today by Tara Ariano, Adam Grossworth, and Kevin O'Keefe. Hello, friends.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for doing this. The Lost Wife of Robert Durst. This one confines itself mostly to the first crime in Robert Durst's roster of weirdness. So let's get into it. It's our most wanted segment. For those of you who did not watch The Jinx, here is the case synopsis. Kathy Durst, medical student and estranged wife of real estate scion and certified kook balloon Robert Durst, disappeared the weekend of January 31, 1982. Robert Durst claimed that he had put his wife on a train at Katona Station and that she had returned to their apartment in Manhattan. But this and other aspects of Durst's account, like all of them, troubled police. Charges were not filed at the time, but police did reopen their investigation in 1999, a turn of events widely believed to have prompted Durst to execute his old friend Susan Berman, who may have been blackmailing him for rent money based on her knowledge of his involvement in Kathy's disappearance. Kathy has never been found. For more on Durst and his almost absurdly murderous nuttiness, please watch The Jinx. It's on HBO Go. Okay. So I suppose we have to start with the Robert Durst impression to which we are treated somewhat inconsistently throughout this film in clip two.
Hi.
Oh, boy. It's a lot of yells.
I like things bright.
Yeah, you definitely do. Blinding, I would say.
Can I help you or are you?
Yeah, I'm here for the rent. Yeah.
The rent, do you work for the building?
I own the building.
Oh.
Well, my family owns the building, and this is so awkward.
No.
What I meant to...
It's okay, I'll get it.
God.
Yeah, it's awkward because you look like Treat Williams, but you sound like the Country Time Lemonade guy. Did you guys find this Robert Durst portrayal convincing, campy, both?
Neither.
Okay.
I mean... Go ahead, Kevin.
I just don't think it was fun enough to be campy. I don't think there. I mean, I'm not so obsessed with Susan Sontag's definition of camp. Like, I'm willing to be a little bit liberal with that. But like, it's not fun or clever in any way. It's just sort of bad, and it gets worse over time. During the movie, like I felt like I was. My understanding of Robert Durst was slipping as the impression got worse over time.
And, you know, in addition to the voice, he's wearing this parade of horrific wigs. I mean, I know the budget is not big for this thing, but like my notes actually say, oh, my God, the 1971 wig. Like it's special, even as bad TV wigs go. And because the story takes place over 20 years, there are many of them. So this is where I confess that I have never seen The Jinx. I live in the world, so I know like the bare minimum about Robert Durst. I know, you know, the basic story, and I know how The Jinx ended, because that was news. But like, if this is the most I've ever seen about him, and it was not followable, really. I mean, it was, because it's not that complicated, but you know, they're clearly assuming that you know this already. And like Kevin said, it's not funny. It's not entertaining. It's just.
Yeah, there. I was going to ask what people thought about that, because I did cover the Jinx for previously.tv. So I was like, you know, in it on a granular level. But I, you know, I thought it was an adequate overview of the case, but there was much too much time jumping. And I kind of wondered who it was for. Tara, did you agree that it was kind of not for either, like, not fans of the case, but like people who know about the case or people who don't?
Yeah, this brings nothing to the experience. I mean, this is not an interesting addition to the Jinx, which is, you know, three times as long and also interviews the real subject. Like, this just seems like Catherine McPhee wanted to make a Lifetime movie, and so this is what they came up for her, because she's the arguably most famous person in it. I mean, Martin Donovan and John Glover also come in, or as my notes have it, quadruple LOL John Glover in all caps playing Robert Durst.
My notes say, what the fuck is John Glover doing here?
But seriously, what is he? I mean,
come on.
My notes said someone has naked pictures of Martin Donovan. So yeah, we were all kind of on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, but the fact that it's her story is made obvious by the fact that whoever is playing Robert Durst is like someone I definitely have never seen before, some Canadian actor. Because, P.S., this is also extremely filmed in Vancouver, as you can tell.
No.
Anytime they... I mean, that penthouse could not be more Vancouver-y, sorry. But I don't know. This is for fans of Lifetime movies that don't really care about the real story so much as just watching a yarn for a couple of hours on a Saturday night, probably. And the fact that the Susan Berman, the blackmail story, is handled in an extremely subtle way, because I forgot that was the supposed motive until you just did the synopsis up top. Like, they really
I did not get black. I mean, admittedly, I had kind of stopped paying attention by then, but I didn't read that phone call as blackmail. So yeah, that was news to me.
You would
too.
Only read it that way if you knew the case and knew that that's probably
right.
Why she was killed,
right.
And then they sort of cram that in at the end.
Yeah, I was gonna say I agree with you that, like, you would get it, but also if you got it, that would seem really ham-fisted. Like, it, going back to your point about this feels made for neither people who have watched the Jinx or not, it's like it's too broad at the end to be an interesting tie-in with the famous, the most famous part of the case, but it's also too subtle where if you don't know the case, you would read the phone call as just kind of more Bobby Durst weirdness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's another thing too. Like, he is presumed to be a creep from moment one. And I mean, he kind of is, but as an audience member imagining that I don't know this case at all, like, why? Like, why is he presented to the audience as so fucking weird before he's even done anything? I mean, I guess because they're assuming that we at least know the basics, but it was very odd.
Right.
Right. Well, the theory that's presented in the Jinx is he was happy in Vermont and then his father brought him back into the business and that made him snap. But this movie also makes sure, in a very Lifetime-y way, to lay in all the signs of trouble, capital S, capital O, capital T. Like, he gets too angry at a snooty Bader D. He controllingly buys a dress for Kathy and for her to wear to some stupid sceney hippie restaurant. Like, they're, you know, he's mad about a flyer about a missing woman. He keeps giving all his dogs the same name. Like, he's great.
Yeah. And he howls
because it's a Lifetime
randomly.
Movie. Like, we know where it's going. Pardon me?
And he howls randomly.
Oh,
I don't.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, you had part of this
early.
In the clip that you called for. Did you want to explain
why?
Yeah,
sure. Let's play that now, because it serves two purposes.
Okay.
You know, my father's got all these buildings and makes these speeches about how he wants to clean up Times Square, but I'm telling you, his places, the dumps, are all filled with, like, hookers and pimps, in my opinion. The whole place is going to the dogs. Just to the dogs.
God.
Well, I like the sound of your dog.
That's as bad as vicious as it gets.
Yeah.
She's so bad. God, I still fucking hate her so much. But like that was the first scene where I was like, oh, she really like it's she just still can't commit to anything. Like, I mean, I guess the point of that scene is like she thinks he's funny and like she likes his quirkiness. But like that's her bark. Like, why? What is the connection between these two people other than he's the guy that came to pick up her rent? Which, by the way, don't just give your rent to some guy who shows up and says, I own the building. By the way, that's a free PSA from me to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think even in 1970, you mailed a check most of the time.
Yeah.
Right.
That's weird. We'll get into her acting, but it's not just the acting. Like, I found this character to be a complete cipher.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
Why at one point she says, I don't want to lose him. And like, why? It was mm-hmm. before he even started hitting her.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I had no idea who she was as a person, which is partly the acting, which we will get to. Yeah.
Well, but and it's partly,
also the writing. I mean there's nothing,
you know,
there.
It's partly probably that it was based on a book where, as so often unfortunately happens with true crime accounts, the victim is like the catalyst for the narrative. So there is this kind of like empty space where the victim is, which is unfortunate, but I don't feel like they needed to do that in this case. And we'll get into that later, like some opportunities that they had to make this a little more interesting and impressionistic. But I did think they did, in some ways, an effective job of making him a creep and reminding people who are familiar with the case that, like, as absurd and laughable as he is with, like, the being a, you know, in drag and mute, not that they brought this part into it, but like he got busted shoplifting a sandwich when he had $500 on him and he's belchy and blinky and a weirdo and it's easy to dismiss him. But I thought some of the scenes were effective and like that the dogs kept disappearing was extremely painful for me. Here's clip four.
Then there's the dogs. There's like five or six dogs that died or disappeared on him. How do six of your dogs disappear suddenly?
I'd also like to say this actor is in the background of several shots looking incredulous and bless his heart. You can see that if you follow us on Twitter at Blotter Presents. But now I guess we have to talk about Cat McPhee's acting. Don't we? Eventually.
It's still bad. She hasn't learned anything.
It's worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have not. Worse. I don't watch Scorpion, so I don't know. But like, she was okay on Smash. Mm. She was outacted by the entire rest of the cast. I am not a fan of Catherine McPhee, but being the worst actor in Smash is different.
Well, and I
then being as bad I as this was.
We should also say the reason that Sarah has assembled this round table is that Adam
revenge
and Kevin and I are all,
Smash.
Are all huge Smash fans, despite Catherine McPhee, I would say probably in at least two of three cases.
Yes.
Yes, totally.
So that's why we're here. Proceed.
Right, well, let's play the clip that Adam called for and then we can discuss why this typifies how bad she is in this. And I will also say I thought that she was okay for what this is. But that's a super low bar, like laying on the ground.
Okay, yeah.
Here's clip five.
Your home is really beautiful.
It's mixed emotions here. We moved into this house after the suicide of her mother.
Suicide? What? I thought she fell. Oh, I didn't know. I'm sorry.
That she's still the worst actor in this scene is really a triumph, or whatever the opposite of a triumph is. An umph. I don't know.
A disaster.
Right. Like, when you're the worst actor with, like, Jack Davenport and Bernadette Peters, okay. When you're the worst actor in this Lifetime movie, it's not okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This was also the scene, I called for this clip, and this was also the scene where I noticed her face. And I don't, Hollywood is terrible. It's terrible to women. I don't want to shit on a woman's face, but like there's something, I don't know if she had work done or if it's Botox or if it's bad makeup or bad lighting, but in this scene especially, and then once I noticed it, I couldn't unsee it. Like her face is not moving normally. And she also then is not speaking like a human. And it just made her feel like robot actor.
I don't necessarily, I mean, I didn't notice that she seemed like she was altered. You know, medically, I just think her face doesn't move because she doesn't know how to move her face because she's bad at acting.
Yeah, I think that's Very likely. Right. And then, you know, you combine that with terrible lighting and it just, it's not a good look on anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this. The budget on Smash was not terrific, especially in those last few episodes. I remember the sad Tony's room that was just like a small like Hilton, not even a full banquet room, just sort of like
they had to pay for Queen, Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. But even there, I mean, she looked like, I think she was sort of lifted up in some way. I'm not saying it was very high, but she was lifted up in some way by everything happening around her. Here, it feels like this is the pure, this is the unfiltered, unrefined version of Kat McPhee's acting. Mm-hmm. Like nothing else around her to sort of cover it up.
Well, she doesn't, yeah. She has no reason to sing. Like that's sort of what smooths her things over for her in Smash, right? Because it was a musical part. So.
Well, or if she has any chance to have any personality whatsoever, like she did in The House Bunny, which I don't think she's very good in The House Bunny either. Mm-hmm. But I think she at least gets something to do.
Yeah.
Adam was so right when he called the character a cipher, because she has no particular emotion about anything except for, I guess, the one scene that sort of made me uncomfortable where she goes to get an abortion. I guess she starts to show some ambivalence about that, but not even to a real extent. It just sort of felt like something Kat McPhee like had put in front of her to read. It didn't feel like this character actually felt that tortured about that decision.
Well, yeah, the script doesn't do her any favors, for sure.
I was just going to say that exact same thing. And not to mention that she's surrounded by some other actors who either are notorious for being big or are just being extra large in their roles. For those of you triggered by the sound of belching, I think there are a few of you, just hit mute for 1 minute while we deal with clip six.
But first, go get your hair cut. This foolishness ends now. You look like a gaggle of dropouts.
Pardon me.
Jesus. What? Bobby.
That was the realest moment, was Douglas Durst being like, Christ's sake. Oh, God. And then there's the actor playing Susan Berman, who is at 11 all the time. Clip seven.
You look pale. You need a drink.
I need a lot more than a drink.
Tell me about it. It took me 3 Valium and 5 Bloody Marys to get through all the stories about you in the papers, Bobby.
How many Valiums?
She is the worst actress in this.
Yeah, she's really bad.
Can we...
Let's be kinder to Kat McPhee for 1 second. She may not be doing much, but that lady does everything. There was nothing left for Kat McPhee to do.
Yeah, there is no acting left for anyone.
And I'll just say, this is a borderline anti-Semitic portrayal of this person. Like, it's so broad and stereotyped. It's really not okay.
Yeah.
There were so many different accents in the show. None of them right.
Brampton. She's not an American.
Sure.
Brampton, Louisiana, because that's kind of where I assumed.
At one point, this is one of my very few notes. The detective in the late 90s scenes,
Sarah,
says, "Who told the papers?"
Yeah.
And I really thought he was. Like he was in Newsies. who told the papes? Like it was so broad and weird. And like, I know it's meant to be somewhere in Southern New York State, but no.
Also a 2-line headline. Come on with the props. Give me a break. That's not how newspapers work.
Seriously.
You're not announcing the end of World War II.
Well, yeah. But again, in their defense, they're dealing with dialogue like what we're about to hear in clip 8.
Oh, God.
Why are you making that face?
I'm not making a face.
Yes, you are. You are making a face.
She's
I'm
not.
Watching you
trust
make
us.
A face.
What are you talking about? I'm not making a face. I just killed our baby.
Wait,
you're telling me.
Oh, Jesus.
Don't you yell at me like that. Bobby!
Oh, I understand the note scuffle now. I was a little confused as to what a scuffle was going to be.
Yeah, I tried to clip this in like a GIF or a screenshot, but like there was some I think it might have been Kids in the Hall, actually, where they're like, girl fight, and then they just like windmill at each other and then cover their heads. My brother and I used to do this as a joke all the time and actually did it as recently as 2 weeks ago. I should not be thinking about this during a portrayal of domestic violence when he's choking her. And apparently he did beat her up. And the fact that that was not taken seriously was perhaps why charges weren't more seriously considered at the time that she disappeared. That was the sort of, you know, the times. But I shouldn't be thinking about a Kids in the Hall sketch, maybe.
Yeah, there's a later scene where he grabs her by her hair and drags her out of her room
in front of her whole family.
Choreography. Yeah. Her whole family who just sit there.
Yes.
And but also that's like fight choreography 101. Like, I'm sorry to make light of the very serious that probably happened to this actual woman, but like it looks so bad. And I don't think she's even wearing a wig. Like, they just like, yeah.
Yeah.
She's the one.
Bad.
Who's not wearing a wig?
Yeah. That's she might have been. She might have. Maybe she brought her own from Scorpion. I don't know. If she was, it was better than all the rest of them.
You could see him looking for his marks. Like, I think they probably put a little piece of tape like on the back of her head. It was not very yeah, convincing.
It was bad.
And the thing is, Tara and I talked about this in a different way on Will and Grace and Kevin and Tara. But the point of something like this, if it's serious, is that we should not be sort of dissecting all of it. Like the way in which it came up in Will and Grace was with Rosario's funeral in the most recent episode. And it just feels like if you do something incompetently, there's no real stake for us as viewers, as analysts on this podcast, to weigh that seriousness the same way. You know, it's hard. Like, we can say, oh, this was a horrible thing that happened, but it's like, it's your crappy fight choreography that makes it look like a joke. You know, it's we're not the ones devaluing how serious domestic violence is.
Yeah.
This movie did by treating it so poorly in the production process.
And that scene in particular, because it happens in front of her whole family, presumably is something that at least one of them reported to the person who wrote the book that this is based on, or the police, or both. But then later, when, you know, things are getting even worse, she's had this affair and he's found that she's sent all the papers to Senator Moynihan, which what? And she's goes to her mother's house on Long Island, and her mother's like, you just have to have faith in your marriage and Bobby. Like, you fucking watched him drag her out by her hair. Like, why did you allow her to go back to him ever? And yet that is just presented as like, well, you know, moms, like, it's not, there's no explanation of like what happened to make her mother take Bobby's side. Like, fuck.
Well, and then when the second detective comes and is like, we have new information and we want to reopen this case, she's like, don't reopen it unless you're totally sure. Like,
right.
Like, we know she's played by Kat McPhee, but Jesus Christ, like, maybe care about your kid. Fuck. Yeah. And then
our other daughter, Megan Hilty, is doing great.
You win some, you lose some. What the hell is that? Speaking of which, I did not love either how the entire narrative kind of stalled for it, like dialectical back and forth between the DA and Detective Martin Donovan about why charges were not being filed in clip 9.
There's no body. If we went forward, think about what would happen. Durst would be indicted. He'd hire the best criminal lawyers with all his money. They'd destroy our case, attack the wife, drag her through the mud. And if Durst is acquitted, which is highly likely, double jeopardy protects him for the rest of his life, even when one day someone does come and tells the truth.
He's guilty, Roger. He did it.
Maybe. But I am partial to winning my cases.
If the if the intended demographic is like the usual Saturday night Lifetime movie viewer, they've seen a gazillion Lifetime movies. They understand how the like TV criminal justice system works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They know double jeopardy. Like, that's not a hard concept to understand.
No.
Yeah.
It's really not. And there were so many other interesting ways that this could have gone. I think maybe Tara and I were of the same mind on that. Tara, do you want to talk about why you called for clip 10?
Oh, just another example of like how ham-fisted the writing is. Just play it and then we can talk about it clipped in.
Something wrong? You seem off.
No, no. It's just Bobby. He's controlling.
At least he's rich. You always say that.
Okay, so here's what's established in that scene. It's known that he's controlling, yet his controlled wife thinks nothing of saying that to someone outside of the situation in so many words, which, like, that's not how domestic abuse works. It's very secret, and you don't announce it like that to your house cleaner. I mean, I guess it's established that they kind of have a friendship as well, but, like, and so that's A. And B, you always say that. So this is a conversation they've had multiple times. And yet nothing has moved forward. The end of the discussion is he's rich, so I guess it's okay. Like, ugh, so bad.
Yeah.
So bad.
The actual end is, do you want to go and get drunk and forget your troubles about your abusive, controlling husband who won't pay your tuition? Like, cool.
Yeah.
Except this character is 20 times more interesting than the lost wife. And
yes,
so are the lost wife's nursing school friends who, like, in the actual case, these women were, like, huge drivers of getting like a missing persons report filed, mm-hmm. staying on top of it, trying to get justice for Kathy. And based on our final clip, I would 10 times rather just watch, like, a, you know, 33 short films about Rebel Nurse Club lunchtime. Here's clip 11.
Wait, what are you talking about?
My mother taught me how to box when I was 12 in our kitchen with gloves and everything. She didn't want anybody kicking me around.
Well, you know, it's actually a good skill to have, like self-defense.
Yeah.
My mom taught me how to make a martini.
Oh, that figures.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, totally. Like, the coven of nursing pals is, like, such a more interesting story and would have been a better way into this story, too, because of exactly what you said, that they did a lot of investigating on their own. So why that wasn't the decision that was made from a dramatic point of view, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess they didn't get the rights to any of those books. Yeah, I can't.
And that scene is such a non sequitur, too.
Yeah. And then,
like,
she's just sitting there.
Was other stuff cut? Yeah, it was just a weird, like, that clip was almost the entire scene. And I was, when I was watching it, I was like, wait, did I miss something? No, this is just here.
Yeah.
And then it's over.
Well, yeah, I mean, I got a lot of knitting done while I was watching this and taking notes, but that's probably not. Like, I can't really.
Y'all took as many notes as you did. I was just sort of sitting there like slack jawed.
Oh, we've gotten through all of my notes.
Just like you, just like Cat McPhee.
I do have one other note, and it's the quote, New York's an expensive place for a dental receptionist. Yes. That classic story as seen on Smash of the dental receptionist moving to New York to follow her dreams of dental receptioning.
Girl what? Needs teeth. Girl loves teeth.
She does have very nice
she
teeth.
She does.
I'll say that about her.
Look, as an actress, she's extremely pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And I think we can leave it there, I guess. This was not, you know, if you didn't
as
watch
a singer,
the Jinx,
she was the
just
second,
watch it.
As a singer, she's the second best Marilyn on Smash. So, you know, there's that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe.
What, are you going to put Uma Thurman above her?
I mean,
yeah, clearly we're going to have a follow-up episode on that. But for now,
there is a crime involved. You haven't gotten to it yet, Sarah.
I can't tell you to follow up on this movie. Alas, it's pretty standard fare. And
yeah, no, it's real bad.
All right. Well, that wraps it up for our most wanted section. And now we're doing something a little different for the cold case section. This is a King of Blank Crime, the musical Mountain. Here's how it's going to work. I wouldn't call musicals about crime a proud tradition necessarily on the stage, but there is precedent. Like American Psycho is sort of partly based on Ted Bundy. Chicago, mm-hmm. Bright Star, there are more examples. So since I have this esteemed panel convened, I am going to ask them and Bank which musical they think should move on to the next round. in case there is not familiarity on anyone's part with a given crime, you all have to sort of vote and answer together, and that determines the answer. So we are going to begin with Ted Bundy, the musical, and Bernardo Homolka, the musical. Panel, which of these should move on?
I am here for Ted Bundy, the musical. I don't know who that second person is.
Yeah, I don't know the other person either, although my instinct is, because American Psycho is partially based on Ted Bundy, to go with the other guy for a new story.
I got to say Bernardo Homolka because they are from one of my hometowns. The crime happened when I was in high school. Paul Bernardo and his wife, Carla Homolka, kidnapped, raped, and murdered two schoolgirls in the early 90s, very early 90s. It's an amazing case that I don't know why it's not covered more. There is at least one Law and Order and I think two different SVUs that were based on it. It's really lurid and awful and, definitely would make a good musical. So that is my vote.
Okay. Alas, it seems as though Ted Bundy has cared. Well, wait, Kevin, was your vote for Bundy or Bernardo?
Bernardo.
Okay, so it's Bernardo and Homolka, the musical, versus Amanda Knox, the musical. Who moves on?
Ooh.
Oh, Amanda Knox.
Cat McPhee could play her. Yeah,
I reluctantly have to agree. That case has got a lot of drama in it for sure.
It would sell way more tickets.
Yes,
it's a much
would.
More recognizable name.
Mm-hmm. Maybe not in Toronto, but in New York for sure.
Yes.
Amanda Knox, the musical, versus Lindbergh Baby, the musical.
I guarantee that there is already a Lindbergh Baby musical, if not six.
But there's more inherent camp value in the Lindbergh Baby than there is in Amanda Knox. I don't know. I guess I vote Amanda Knox just because I want a full staged Italian number.
I'm going to say Lindbergh because I think it has ragtimey potential. So that's my vote.
Okay.
Mm.
I just Googled it. It's called Baby Case.
Ooh. Oh.
And and it played the New York Musical Theater Festival in 2012 and won the Best of the Fest Award.
Wow.
So I didn't see it, but yeah. So I don't know if we're going to go with the real thing or we should stick with the making them up.
Let's stick with making them up. What is your vote?
I'm going to go with Knox because it doesn't exist
yet. All right.
Yeah.
So Knox is moving on again. Amazing. Amanda Knox, the musical versus Spirit of Dave Cole, Hear My Cry. D.B. Cooper, the musical. Yes, there will be wire work. D.B. Cooper, Turn Off the Dark.
I mean,
that's what I was thinking.
D.B. Cooper gets my vote for sure.
As mine.
Okay. D.B.
I'm already dreamcasting it.
D.B. Cooper, the musical versus Black Dahlia, the musical.
Cooper.
D.B. Cooper, the musical versus Biggie and Tupac, the musical.
Oh, Biggie and Tupac. Easy.
I feel like that story's been done a bunch. Cooper has more potential drama.
Musical?
He jumps out of a
there
plane.
Was the Tupac musical and it was really bad.
Oh yeah, what was that one called?
Holler If You Hear Me. I mean, it was not a biographical. It just used his music. So
right. I'm sticking on Cooper.
Yeah, I'm gonna skip with Cooper too.
Okay, I'm outvoted.
D.B. Cooper, the musical, versus Oliver Stone's JFK, the musical.
D.B. Cooper.
I'm going to say JFK just because of the millions of Broadway actors it would employ, potentially, that part of. That movie has like 6,000 speaking roles, so.
But didn't we get the perfect story of JFK in the song Our Little Secret, written by Julia Houston and Tom Levitt in Bombshell?
Even so.
Just for that,
I'm
going with JFK.
I'm very interested to see who wins this next one. Oliver Stone's JFK, the musical, versus Kitty Genovese, the musical.
There is absolutely already a Kitty Genovese musical. So I know there is. So I am voting for JFK. I don't even need to Google that one. There is, I think there's a musical and an opera.
I know there's an opera. I didn't realize there was a musical as well.
Yeah, there's also, it's called The Screams of Kitty Genovese.
Jesus. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, so JFK for me.
JFK.
Okay, final round. Oliver Stone's JFK the musical versus Zodiac the musical.
Ooh.
Zodiac.
Yeah. Zodiac.
Zodiac directed by
okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Everyone's a different sign of the Zodiac and they dance. It's amazing.
Love it. And there's like glow in the dark paint. Yeah, I'm seeing it.
Yes.
Definitely seeing it. All right, folks, thank you so much for playing that with me. And now it's time for you to tell the listeners where they can be on the lookout for you. Tara, do you want to start us off?
Well, you can find me and Kevin on the aforementioned Will and Grace and Kevin and Tara podcast, which you can find along with all of our other podcasts at previously.tv/podcast. I am on a bunch of those.
Excellent. Adam?
We just wrapped our second season of Two Spotted Dicks.
Your second season about season 8 of that show.
Yes, correct. Our second season of the podcast, which we did on the British schedule. So you may not have listened to it yet because you might be waiting to watch the show.
And make sure you
PBS.
follow so, either at Two Spotted Dicks or at Previously TV on Twitter and your various social networks, because we will alert you and remind you that those podcasts exist when it comes to American shores.
Yes,
indeed. Kevin.
Well, I am on the podcast with Tara, Will and Grace, and Kevin and Tara, that we are indeed the Will and Grace of that four names. And then I also have a over at IntoMore.com, which is Grindr's new magazine, Into. I have a weekly movie review column called But How Gay Is It? In which I tell you of all the most recent releases, I pick one and I tell you exactly how gay it is. The most recent one was A Bad Mom's Christmas, which, despite Christine Baranski's presence and a naked Justin Hartley from This Is Us, is only kind of gay.
Oh, disappointing.
So that goes up that goes up every Friday at IntoMore.com.
That is good intel. Well, thank you all for being here. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, we've got returning guest Eve Beatty on Yet More Zodiac. We've got first-time guest Lisa Schmeiser on Truman Capote and In Cold Blood. And of course, on a weekly basis, you've got my girl T-Bone on The Blotter Presents, Summary Judgment, Law & Order True Crime, The Menendez Murders.
Why does that name have to be so long?
Colon.
The colon.
It's a lot of colons.
It's a lot of colon. How, I'm not sure how, yeah.
Okay, is that?
That's real gay.
Pretty gay. I am Sarah D. Bunting. I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can also follow this podcast on Twitter and like it on Facebook at Blotter Presents. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.